Shalom uvracha. This is Rabbi Winkler again, hoping that all is well with you and your families, and that those who are currently suffering an illness will have a quick refuah shlema, and those of us who have remained outside of the direct impact of the coronavirus will soon have our lives returned to normal. For us and for all of Klal Yisrael. The last lecture that I recorded last week went through, I could call it the roaring 30s, because so much went on. And as I'm focusing on the story of the Zionism and what was happening in the Yishuv, it is absolutely impossible to continue without including also what was going on in Europe. And so we went through the first directives of the Nazi Party and of Yimach Shemo of Hitler, and how it impacted, of course, the Jews in Germany. But more than that, we went through the reaction of outside countries, including the democracies, and how indeed they could not, or they did not, open their doors to the Jewish refugees. If you recall, I specifically went through the reaction in the United States, and truthfully, that really requires at least a separate lecture by itself, even the attitude of the president, President Roosevelt, and what may have been the factors that impacted his rather insensitive reaction, not only in the 1930s, but indeed up until 1944, toward the end of the Holocaust. That really is beyond the dimensions, I should say, of this lecture, but perhaps at one point we will get through that. I left you with the rather optimistic story of the Levant Fair, and how the Yishuv at the time had really grown, had gone through what I call the Industrial Revolution, and how it had the economy had changed from a agricultural base now to an industrial base, and the reactions of those companies who came to the fair changed the attitude and the view of this little corner of the world, of Palestine, and of the Jewish impact, the Aliyah impact, to life there for both Jews and Arabs. And I left off, if I recall correctly, with the quotations from the movie called The Land of Promise that was put out by the Keren HaYesod, which told of the progress that was being made there, and how amazing the improvement in life had taken place over the last 15 years. Meanwhile, other things were going on in the Yishuv. We were in the middle still of the Arab Rebellion, the Arab Revolution, which began really in 1936. And there were some very fascinating side results of this revolution, which we will get to. But about this time, Palestine now had a new high commissioner. His name was Sir Arthur Waushop. That's Waushope. He impressed the Jewish community with his very cordial manner and with his positive attitude towards Zionism. Waushop's term of office covered these years of progress and growth within the Jewish community, within the Yishuv in Palestine. In fact, he served as a guest of honor at all Zionist events. And for a high commissioner, that was quite a step to make. However, we have to be realistic. He was a British high commissioner, and he was charged with carrying out British policy. He was concerned over this rapid pace of progress. Now, although it was true that the mandate was exactly that, the League of Nations gave Britain a mandate, a charge to watch over, take care of Palestine until the Jewish leadership was in place and it was capable for them to run a country, to make an independent Jewish state. That was their mandate. And one cannot emphasize that more because, as we'll see, within a year or two, by the end of the 1930s, British had officially changed their attitude and really undermined the mandate. That very vote in the League of Nations that gave them the power to rule over Palestine, and indeed they did rule over Palestine, that power was given to them for the accomplishment of creating a Jewish state. They rejected that, and they went on to do everything, or many things, to make sure the Jewish state would not be formed. That was not true of Waschup himself, but he saw that the pace of the events and activities were far too rapid for him. And so he met with Chaim Weizmann, and he counseled him on numerous occasions to slow down the building, the opening of, for example, 52 settlements in the early 1930s, the Choma u'Migdal period, where settlements were growing, and within a few years, 52 new settlements were founded. He felt that this was far too fast for the Arab majority to accept, and asked them to slow down the building. He would say to Weizmann, to build solidly is to build slowly, gradually. Weizmann is said to have responded, and I quote this, "I appreciate the wisdom of your suggestion, and so, indeed, we would proceed, were it not for the fact that we are now being chased by all the demons of hell." Weizmann reminded the British of what Jews were going through in Germany and, as we'll see soon, in Austria and other countries. And although so far we've painted for you a rather glorious picture of the advances, of the progress of the Yishuv in the 30s, but certainly that was not the entire picture. There was still a British limitation to legal immigration, somewhat, and with the added industry, there was a desperate need for labor. Now, add to that desperation, if I can use that term, of the Yishuv to get workers, there was, of course, the real desperation of Jews escaping from Europe. Both of these things made the situation more than simply difficult. It made it almost impossible. Meanwhile, the Arabs intensified their demands to stop not some, but all Jewish immigration into Palestine. And this is when the British begin to limit even more any entry permits for Jews into Palestine. The Jewish Agency, for example, and this is back in 1934, requested 21,000 permits to allow Jews to come in. And the British agreed to only 5,000. The British response was seen as so dangerous and literally so insensitive that the Jews called for a labor strike, and they demonstrated against the British decision. So strong were these demonstrations that there were violent clashes with the British police. So while the anti-Semitic laws and the attacks continued throughout Germany, there were also attacks in the Yishuv in Palestine. But there were, of course, the Jewish response. It wasn't simply demonstrations, because there were always ways. Even by the organized illegal aliyah, there was illegal aliyah beyond that. Jews found their ways to infiltrate into Palestine. Some indeed used the illegal aliyah of the ships and so on and so forth, but some slipped past border control. Some created fictitious marriages with those who lived there, and some were even more imaginative. And I'll give you an example. In 1935, the Jews of Palestine hosted what they called the Maccabiah Games. We are all familiar with those from today, but they have continued to today. The Maccabiah Games Jewish sportsmen from different countries who would come and compete in their holy land. Well, in 1935, a team came to represent Germany, believe it or not. And by the close of the games, they asked each other, what will we do now? Should we return to Germany? And a number of athletes and tourists, by the way, who came to view these games, remained in Palestine. Many of these refugees had to go through what they called vocational retraining. We've seen that in our own lifetimes with the Russian Aliyah. So the same thing happened now. Opera singers, well-known actors, became hot dog street vendors. A soccer player became a construction worker. And a PhD scholar became simply a kibbutznik. A famous musician from Berlin became a Moshav farmer. Interestingly, 25% of German immigrants began their new lives as agricultural workers. And so in August 1935, the 19th Zionist Congress met in Lucerne, and no important decisions were made, and no arguments ensued. Sadly, the tragic situation of German Jewry, now in the third year of Hitler's rule, that situation was not even on the agenda. However, there was a German Zionist delegation present, as was, of course, a Gestapo agent. Also, Weizmann returned to the presidency of the Zionist organization, but he was no longer the indisputable leader. Now, labor Zionist, the leader of the labor Zionists, a man by the name of David Ben-Gurion, he who was recently elected chairman of the Zionist executive and of the Jewish agency, he now emerges as the most powerful voice for the Zionist Jews in the Yishuv. And 2 weeks after the Zionist Congress, Hitler passes the infamous Nuremberg Laws, in which he revokes German citizenship from all Jews. It is of little wonder that the largest number of immigrants ever to arrive up to then now enter Palestine. 69,000 Jews. And this is how the Jewish population of Palestine grows due to the persecution of the Jews in Germany and in Eastern Europe. The irony, of course, of the cause of the building of the State of Israel and of the populating of Jews populating Palestine was a result of persecution. It was a result of what the rabbis would have called, when Purim came, sinat Haman, the hatred of Haman, and not ahavat Mordechai, not because of the love of Mordechai. Now, the next step, perhaps, in this these lectures would continue perhaps discussing the Yishuv. But I think it is imperative in order to understand what was going on to really give you the events in Europe that we've touched upon, but that we haven't really gone into detail. The rise of Hitler to power in Germany and the increasing edicts against the Jews. It would include also the Anschluss into Austria. And though I don't believe we'd have time today to go through that, I think it's important in order to get a feel of what was going on at the time, which impacted the Jews in Palestine, as it did the Jews all over the world, it's important for us to really begin now recording the events that led to the most horrible mass murder in the history of mankind. It's a trauma of the 1930s in Europe. So let's begin there. And we will, of course, be touching upon the Yishuv and its impact, and we'll be going back to what was going on there. I've often told the class that what we need is two or three screens in which to show what was happening at the same time, and that's an impossibility. So we have to go from one era to another sometimes. We could go up to 1938 in the Yishuv and now have to go back to 1933 in Europe, but that's the only way that I feel we can properly lay the ground for you to understand why certain things were happening and what caused certain events and certain decisions. It was in 1933 that the German democracy, known as the Weimar Republic, committed virtual suicide. It sounds foolish to say that, but that's exactly what they did. They had free and democratic elections, as a democracy would, but the people put an end to that democracy. Understand, the German people were weary and tired of the post-war depression. They had collapsed economically from the heavy reparations that were forced upon them by the Allies after World War I, combined with the general depression that hit the world at the end of the 20s and the 30s. And the result of that, and the reaction to that, was the growth of the Nazi Party. Nazi Party had begun in the 1920s. Its leader, Hitler, was seen primarily as a joke, even though at times the industrialists did support him, and we'll go through why. They figured they would be able to control him. And once he gets to power, all of his rather extreme comments and speeches would be changed, because when you get to the realistic position of being a leader, that which you may have promised before you were voted in does change. The Germans, therefore, were tired of this. And so the Nazi Party, by the time the 1932 election has come, has now grown more and more and become more popular. They've garnered more than 30% of the vote in the 1932 election. And the weakness and the weaknesses of the other democratic parties prevented them from forming a government. Sounds familiar sometimes. So the elderly president, von Hindenburg, who was a World War I hero, he turned to Adolf Hitler and he appointed him chancellor. Now, we're going to go through this later, but I want you to be aware of the fact that the Gemara talks about a time in Jewish history where there were people called the Biryonim. They were basically bullies, criminals, who through violence would get their way and who frightened the people and threatened the people, and people just did not want to respond to them. And that's exactly what happens here. The democratic government was now replaced by the cruelest and most barbaric power in history, and a long, savage period of darkness descended upon not only Germany, not only Europe, but upon the entire earth. The most fearsome epoch in the long and painful history of the Jewish people. Hitler revoked all democratic freedoms and began a campaign of intimidation against his enemies. And his enemies included the communists, the social democrats, the liberals, but primarily his enemies were the Jews whom he intended, therefore, to remove from Germany. The rise and fall of Hitler is a dramatic and unbelievable story, and yet, tragically, it is true. It's hard to fathom why and how. As I pointed out, and this is also part of the background, post-war Germany was in economic ruin because of the reparations. There was, at the same time as a depression, a horrible inflation. And there were internal divisions. The National Socialists, Nazis against the Communists. And the Nazis succeed in mobilizing the Communist youth to the Nazi cause. Basically, they look for a strong government in times of chaos. A totalitarian solution. This is not uncommon. This is not something that should shock us. The truth of the matter is that this is precisely what people want. They want a quick fix. They want instant coffee. They want Mashiach now. They want to have things change and get fixed, and they don't care how it's going to get done. Hitler himself was born in Austria and outside of Linz, and he eventually moves to Vienna. His past is not well known. It's shrouded in mystery. There are claims that he was 1/16th Jewish. He was his one grandparent was Jewish. We don't know if that's true. That he was an illegitimate son, and he takes the name of his Hitler. His mother's maiden name was Schicklgruber. He, from the time of his youth, was a very strange personality. He certainly had an ego. Believing he was destined for greatness. And as we will see, much of what happened to him reinforces his idea that he was born to be great. We'll touch upon that too. And he begins his life as a painter, and he was very impressed with himself. Unfortunately for us, nobody else was. And this artist painter was not recognized. This frustrates him. He eventually becomes a house painter. From the time he was young, he was a rabid anti-Semite. The stories go why. One can never be sure. His mother died of cancer, and the doctor was Jewish. When he couldn't pay any rent, he was evicted from his apartment in Vienna. And the landlord was Jewish, and he had Jewish lawyers. So one cannot say this is what caused his anti-Semitism. Certainly, it's something he had beforehand. You should remember that Vienna was a hub of anti-Semitism at the time. Its mayor was a famous or infamous anti-Semite. And this simply reinforced his views. In fact, anti-Semitism was his life's obsession. Those who've read Lucy Davidowitz's book, when she points out and proves the fact that to him it was even more important to destroy Jews than it was for him to rule the world. At the crucial part, the end of the war, when it was clear that Germany was failing and that they would be conquered, he rather than send supplies to the troops on the border to fight back the enemy, he used those trains to bring the Jews to the death camps. That was his goal, not controlling the world or ruling over the world, but killing Jews. At any rate, the in World War I, Hitler volunteers for the German army, and that's where he develops an Aryan philosophy, having read that it was also pushed by Nietzsche, of course, by famous anti-Semites like Wagner, and like I told you, the mayor of Vienna, Luger. He serves in the German army during World War I as a runner. I recall Rabbi Wein, Shlita, telling that this was basically a death sentence. The runner's life expectancy of a runner was a few days, or maybe a week or two. The runner was the one who ran from foxhole to foxhole, giving military plans to the commanders what to do. And he went from foxhole to foxhole when the enemy is shooting is a very difficult thing. He survives 4 years, not 1 or 2 weeks, 4 years. And that, again, is one of the things that convinces Hitler that he has been chosen by providence. He is, and I'm afraid to use the term for him, but it was a survivor. He survived that. And although he was not a religious person at all, may have been, in fact, a complete non-believer, he just felt he was chosen for something special in life. In October of 1918, a month before the war ended, he's wounded by poison gas, and the vast majority of soldiers who were exposed to poison gas die a very slow and painful death. Hitler survives. He survives after 2 years in the hospital. And once again, he confirms that although physically he didn't seem to be Aryan, he knew that he was an Übermensch. He was a Superman and being able to do this. After the war, there was great turmoil, of course, in Germany. There were many nationalist parties. They're called Völkische parties. And they all had a common theme. The theme, which, by the way, was common in France, also after the war against Prussia, 1870, was that we are too great to have lost the war. Germany must have been betrayed. That's why they lost World War I, much as I said, the French said. And of course, as the French said, we were betrayed by a Jew, by Alfred Dreyfus. The Germans said we were betrayed by the Jews, or by communists, or by socialists, or by Bundists. It doesn't matter, because all Jews were communists, or socialists, or Bundists. When you're an anti-Semite, you don't need logic or reason. And they therefore believe that democracy must go. And this is the failure of the Weimar Republic. They were unable to cope with the economic crisis. And as any democracy, you cannot respond quickly. You have votes to go through the Bundestag. You have to go through a parliament. You have to go through a Congress. You have to pass laws. It takes time. And as I pointed out before, they want it now. It's not the nature of democracy to do something quickly. It's a very unwieldy political system. As Churchill said, it is the worst political system except for all the others. Filibustering and so on and so forth, we all know democracies don't necessarily work quickly. And there was also a demand for law and order. The Germans, as we know from personality, have a culture of wanting punctuality and everything in order. They abhor chaos and anarchy. And these parties, therefore, appealed to many Germans. They couldn't handle the disorder. And that's what was happening post-World War I. Added to that, of course, was the fact that, as I pointed out again, the punishments, the fines, the agreement in the Treaty of Paris, or the better known as, Treaty of Versailles, it was the details there really impoverished Germany. They were given, and I discussed this in earlier lectures, they were told to pay up
something which, amount of money which, even if they gave every single penny that was ever raised in the whole country, they couldn't do. It was an impossible thing. Hitler was a seventh member of a Volkische party, which was founded in 1921, called the National Socialist Party. One of the original members was Rudolf Hess. It was actually an offshoot of another small Volkische party, and it was going nowhere. It was Hitler who was a remarkable orator. It was he who gave the party life. He imbued it with a platform, with ideals, with character. He was the driving force behind the growth of this Volkische party. However, Hitler was impatient, and this eventually was part of his success. But at this point in time, in the 1920s, it led to his downfall. And he tries to overthrow the government in 1923. His party was made up of veterans of the war who were committed to his nationalist philosophy and anti-Semitic ideas. And this putsch, this attempt, a coup to throw over the government, was failed. Hitler was arrested. He was tried for sedition as a traitor. He was sentenced to prison, but never went there. He lived under house arrest. And for these two and a half years, that's when he wrote Mein Kampf. And he actually ran the party and expanded it from his imprisonment. And he begins to attract important people. And all of them, as I pointed out, felt that they could control Hitler. In the end, it is he who controlled them, whether there was industrialists or militarists or politicians. Eventually, he destroyed them. Mein Kampf is... I won't speak about the book itself. The idea of unifying Germany and rearming Germany against the Versailles Treaty. In fact, he also said we have to abrogate the treaty, take back lost territories, unite all German-speaking peoples under one rule in Germany, to destroy, therefore, Czechoslovakia, retake Danzig and the Polish corridor, to rid the world of Jews and the Jewish virus, to destroy Bolshevism in Russia, to acquire what he would call Lebensraum, living room for Germany, which was, of course, was theirs as a right because they were Übermenschen, they were supermen, they were above and Aryan, greater than other parts of humanity. This was his belief. This is precisely what he worked on. It is frightening, however, how precise the predictions were. Frightening because the world ignored them. As I pointed out before, everyone thought he was really not an important person, that he would never come to power. And if he did, he would never follow through on these threats or on this program that he had. The growth of his party, in general, National Socialism, was fed by a real fear of communism. Communist leader in Germany, the German communist leader, was a woman, and she was a Jewish woman. Rosa Luxemburg, the Red Rose, as she was called. The Jews were very prominent in the party. Understand, it's hard for us to see objectively. Communism was an extremely, tempting, had a tempting program for those who were constantly, over the years, over the centuries, being oppressed and treated unfairly. And Jews, therefore, naturally tended to see in it a very attractive philosophy, where the poor won't be poor, where they would not be trodden by the wealthy, that all would share the wealth, that they would all be brothers, that they would all be equal. It's a very tempting, a very liberal, obviously, philosophy. And Jews are by nature people who like things that they see are equal and fair. And that was true in the beginning of the Communist Party, even before the Russian Revolution. It was heavily, heavily populated by Jews who saw this as a way out of their of the pogroms and of the persecution they had under the czars. And the communist parties controlled the unions. And the Germans didn't accept the idea of striking, of stopping. At the end of World War I, the unions turned against the Kaiser of Germany. And that sped up the end of the war because they reduced the production of military weapons and that which was needed. And therefore, the population feared communism. Trotsky and others saw Germany, they were Russians, but they saw Germany as the next communist country. And Hitler played upon those fears. I'm going to continue, please God, next time with the story, the sad story of Hitler and his rise to power. And we will discuss then also how this is going to impact the yeshuv, as it does, Jews around the world. I wish you all health. I wish you all a time where we can get back to the shigra, to the usual way of life, but always remembering that this is something that was brought on, and we have to turn to Kadosh Baruch Hu for his mercies, and so that we can see an end to this virus, and Emir to Hashem, the real beginning or the continuation of our geula, and hopefully hear the comings of Mashiach Tzidkenu. All the best to everyone.